Welcome to Fronteras, a program that explores issues at the border and beyond through the lens of arts, culture, and history. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. We're a few weeks out from the Day of the Dead, El Día de los Muertos. Its traditions date back 3,000 years to the Aztecs and continue today. Families gather at cemeteries to remember, eat, and talk with their loved ones. Altars, or ofrendas, feature photos, items, and even food or drink that was associated with the person who's moved on. Too many people have died in the last 19 months who should still be here. Too many altars have too many recuerdos, mementos, and memories. Writer Oscar Cáceres published an article in Texas Monthly last November to coincide with the Day of the Dead. It's called, This Year, Our Family's Día de los Muertos Altar Will Memorialize Those Who Have Died from the Coronavirus. We invited Oscar to Fronteras to read from the essay and talk about what inspired it.
Other than a few framed photos of family and friends who had passed away over the years, there wasn't much in the way of decorations when my family set up our first Día de los Muertos altar. Later came the banner of papel picado, and the year after that, the tiny sugar skulls. But no matter how our family altar has changed, it's always with the same centerpiece, a grapefruit, that takes us back to a faraway memory of how it all began. It's 1938, and my father is a young man. He lives in Donna, just a few miles north of the Rio Grande, where he works at a packing shed. One afternoon, he's loading crates of grapefruit onto the back of a truck when he spots a group of high school girls walking by. He tries to make eye contact with one of them and has no luck. Then he sees a little boy playing near the packing shed and has an idea. He tosses the boy a grapefruit and tells him to run over there and give it to the girl with the gray gingham skirt. Tell her there's someone who wants to meet her, he says. Andale! And the boy delivers the gift. And this is how my parents become my parents and why every year a ruby red grapefruit sits on the altar.
So, Oscar, the piece that you have just read an excerpt from is from a November 2020 issue of Texas Monthly, and it was tied in to the pandemic and how Día de los Muertos kind of had a different angle and how a lot of people have a different perspective of it because of so many deaths that have occurred in the past year. When you were writing this article, did you also have that sense that this Día de los Muertos is unlike any other Día de los Muertos and remembrance of people who have come and gone in the past? How has that been different for you? And I mean, now we're coming upon a brand new Día de los Muertos here in just a few weeks.
Yeah, that's a great question, Norma. And, you know, to tell you the truth, I had some sense of it. I didn't realize the full impact and what people would be going through. You know, for me, writing this essay sort of happened in a kind of a, I don't want to call it a perfect storm, but there were just a lot of elements that came together. I had been wanting to write something about Día de los Muertos for quite some time, but I couldn't put my head around it and figure out the angle that I wanted to write about this from. And then we find ourselves in this pandemic and we find ourselves losing very close, you know, relatives and friends and such. In particular, I had lost a very close cousin down in the valley. And what struck me and that I realized was happening not just in the valley, but all over the place, was not only the loss, but the loss of the rituals that we go through when we lose someone, right? You know, that part of it is so consequential to the process and eventually to the healing of the letting go, at least physically, as much as we can. And that too had been stolen from us with the pandemic. And for me, the idea of setting up an altar, it really started for the most selfish of reasons, I have to admit, because I had not grown up with any semblance of this part of the culture in my life. I had a lot of other things, but what we didn't have, my parents never did a Dia de los Muertos altar or anything like that.
I was the same way.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'd heard of it, and I'm sure there were families that we knew of, but I'd never really seen one. And so it dawned on me that, you know, setting up the shrine, bringing out the photos, having the ofrenda, just all these things was going to be an opportunity for me to not just keep their memories alive of my parents and cousins and tios and tias and what have you, but an opportunity to tell their stories. And I tell their stories. I mean, my poor kids have to hear their stories about their grandparents and their tios and tias all the time. But this was a very legitimate way of bringing up the stories because it was that time of year, right? And so when I bring these things out, whether, you know, it's the photo or it's the grapefruit that is very much associated with my parents meeting, my children automatically know what the story is. And the idea really came down to giving them a sense of their history, of our history in this region, of how long we have been here, and a grounding of sorts so that they understood that they came from a long line of people. When I was a kid, I thought I was cursed, Norma. I thought I was just absolutely cursed because I had been born into what seemed like a family of prehistoric people. My father had been born in 1914. My mother in 1922. And I was born in 1964. Okay. So my dad had just turned 50. My mom had turned 42. Now, in today's terms, you know, that's not such a weird thing. But back in the 60s, having a baby at that age was just weird. You know, it was uncommon, and it was almost always what we call a happy accident, right? It was never a planned thing. They were celebrating, get this, they were celebrating their 25th wedding anniversary.
Wow.
About the time that I was born. Okay. They already had a kid in college. They had another one about to go to college. They had one who was going to Vietnam, and they had a baby at home. To me, it was like, my God, these very, very old people. Well, what I didn't realize is that being born into such a family with that kind of history, those kind of roots, also comes with a lot of stories. And so, you know, what I thought was a curse turned out to be a real blessing. But, you know, I also grew up because of those circumstances, because of that age gap. You know, my father was one of 11 and my mom was one of 10 in her family. So these fairly sizable families, and I'm born pretty late into the game, you know, I end up attending a lot of funerals. Funerals become pretty common in my family, right? They're not something that is feared or, I mean, it's a part of life, you know, it's something we do. And quite frankly, I mean, it always sounds a little weird when I say it, but some of my best memories are from funerals.
They're family reunions.
Absolutely. And for months and sometimes years, I would hear about, you know, such and such deal that lives up in Chicago, or this one that lives in Michigan, or this one that moved out to California. It was the funerals that brought them back. And it was a lot of times really sad initially, especially if the death was unexpected. But then there was the time after the funeral when everyone would gather and the stories would begin. And it was like, oh my goodness. And so as a kid, I was just like, I don't want to say I was in heaven, but I was, there was a part of it that I really relished. For all the sadness, there is some joy here to see the faces and hear the laughter, and they were reconnecting. They were picking up right where they left off, and the stories would start. And it was amazing. every time.
And that was also something that was stolen from us during the pandemic. And you do write about that in this article from 2020 in Texas Monthly, the fact that we don't have funerals anymore. I think now we're starting to see them starting to become more public again. But back when you wrote this article, you could not go to a funeral. Maybe you could catch it on Zoom. And Oscar, we're a huggy people. We like hug, and we love to cry together and hug together, and we smile. We're always touching, and there's no such thing as personal space in our culture.
No, you should meet my tia Minerva. You have to get a restraining order from her. But yes, we are a very touchy-feely people, and proudly so, you know. When my cousin Beto died a year ago now, July, it was live streamed. And so I sat right where I am sitting right now and watched it on a live stream. And it was heartbreaking. It was heartbreaking, you know, for what had happened to him, but also heartbreaking for what I was witnessing, the way his kids were. They showed up to the service and everything, but you could only sit with the people that you lived with. Each household had to sit unto itself. They could be in this very large church, but they could not gather as a family, as we normally do. It was just, you hear about it, you read about it, but until you've experienced it at that level, it seems far off and very abstract. And so both the idea of where the, for me, the idea of even setting up a Dia de los Muertos altar, and then the fact that it was meant to keep these stories alive and keep the stories alive of who my parents kept closest to them, who were their dearest relatives and such. And my cousin Beto was my father's favorite nephew. If my father had been alive, he would have just been absolutely heartbroken by Beto's passing. And then Beto's wife passing within 48 hours of him. It was a tragedy on so many different levels.
We're talking with writer Oscar Cáceres, author of the story collection Brownsville and the novels Amigo Land and Where We Come From. When we come back, the pandemic has robbed us of how we mourn. Dia de los Muertos altars are sometimes all people have to remember.
Maybe the only way they've been able to express this grief in a more open fashion, in a way that feels a little bit more normal, you know, whatever that means anymore.
Our conversation continues next on Fronteras. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Writer Oscar Cáceres is from the border, Brownsville. He's written several essays about the border, and as you'll hear later in the interview, he's obsessed with the border. Cáceres is from the Rio Grande Valley, which suffered a heartbreaking number of COVID-19 deaths during last winter's surge. In November 2020, Texas Monthly published an essay by Cáceres titled, "This Year, Our Family's Dia de los Muertos Altar Will Memorialize Those Who've Died from the Coronavirus." In it, Oscar writes about the loss of his cousin Beto to the virus.
My father died in 2007, but I wonder how he would have reacted to seeing all the parents and grandparents, tías and tíos and primas and primos who have fallen to COVID-19 in the Rio Grande Valley, especially in Hidalgo County, which is more than 90% Latino and became the epicenter of the crisis in Texas this summer. The county represents only 3% of Texas' population, but accounted for 21% of its coronavirus deaths then. It was here in late July that we lost my father's favorite nephew, my cousin, A.C. Beto Jaime. A couple of days later, his wife of 63 years, Dora, also passed away from the coronavirus. After a lifetime of civic involvement, including his time as the first Mexican-American mayor of FAR from 1972 to 1978, Beto was well known in the area. but due to social distancing mandates, his and Dora's combined funeral service was limited to immediate family, all of them wearing masks and discouraged from hugging and crying on each other's shoulders. I can't imagine how my father would have made sense of the restrictions and prevented the family members from being with Beto inside the ICU, holding his hand as he took his last breath. What would my father say if I told him that we could only watch the live stream of the funeral on my laptop, the same one I'm using to type these words now? If he had watched a pair of attendants wheel the two caskets up the aisle and place them near the altar, side by side, would he have felt a terrible sob catch in his throat as it did in mine? Of the many ways this pandemic has felt so unfair, it sometimes feels as if the cruelest part has been how it has deprived us of this ritual of grieving our losses together. Growing up along the border, we were all reminded of how precarious life could be, but also of how we would always be there for one another. We understood that, no matter what, those of us left behind wouldn't carry this loss by ourselves. Accepting these recent deaths in isolation has been even more difficult since we're a family of touchy and feely people. We hug, we kiss, we cry, we hug some more. No one cries as long and as passionately as my tia Minerva, who 6 years ago at my mother's burial had to be held back from clinging to the casket as it was lowered into the ground. I still remember the abrazo Beto gave me at my father's rosary, patting me on the back as he squeezed me a little tighter, reminding me over and over that I wasn't going through this alone.
So, Oscar, it seems almost like the ofrendas, the altars that we have of our loved ones who passed away, that we never really got a chance to say goodbye to, that, in a way, is probably the only way some of us can actually honor them now, since we don't have that ritual, or we didn't have that ritual of a burial when so many people were dying last year.
Yeah, no, I mean, that process, that pre-COVID, you knew what the steps were. You knew there would be a rosary. You knew the relatives would start arriving. You knew that some would make it in time for the rosary, and some would trickle in toward the end. You know, there would be some gathering between the rosary and the funeral, and then the day of the funeral and the pallbearers, all of that. It's part of coping with the loss. You know, as I mentioned in the essay, to begin with, dying in isolation is dreadful in its own way. I think Beto may have had a last phone call with his son, but nobody else was in the room other than medical personnel. For those who have altars, yes, that has been, I can imagine, maybe the only way they've been able to express this grief in a more open fashion, in a way that feels a little bit more normal, you know, whatever that means anymore.
Well, since your article came out last November, what kind of response have you gotten from readers who have read it?
I've been touched by the people that have reached out to me. It's, you know, I think when you're in the middle of such a trying time like this, that you're trying to simply get through it. You're trying to get to the other side of it. And so you end up suppressing a lot of the feelings that might have bubbled up to the surface. And so I think that with the people that I heard from, it was a lot of this. It was a lot of missing that part of the ritual, missing the goodbye. I mean, you know, we talk about being a huggy feely people. I mean, one of the cornerstones, I mean, when you're growing up, when I was growing up, was the idea of arriving somewhere and saying hello. You're taught that as a kid, but yes. There's also the despedida, right?
Yes.
And you do not leave without saying goodbye.
To everybody.
Yes, to every, you got to go to every relative and say goodbye. You know, we don't even end our corridos without a despedida, right? Everything is ritualized, right? Again, you know, to have that taken away, to have the goodbye taken away. I mean, it's one thing to have the mother, the father, the grandmother taken away, but then to also have to not have had the chance to say that goodbye. And that is generally the case with many of these COVID situations. There simply is not the opportunity to say goodbye because they're in isolation.
People who listen frequently to Fronteras, they might recall that you were a guest a few months ago when we did a program with you and Joel Salcido, a photographer from El Paso and a member of the Aguarita Chamber Players. You were working on a collaboration called Postcards from the Border, which also came from a Texas Monthly collaboration that you and Joel did. And you're actually going to be collaborating again with Aguarita for, I guess, a live version of Postcards from the Border. The version that we talked about on Fronteras was a virtual version. Can you tell us a little bit sort of about resurrecting this program now with a different view towards an audience?
You know, we had intended to have an audience the first time around, and then, you know, for obvious reasons and safety protocol, we had to pull back on that. And so we had the recording, and it was online, and it was nice, but there's a difference between doing it live and doing it pre-recorded. And so we're very much looking forward to this opportunity. I mean, all the precautions will be taken for the audience and for the performers as well. But the piece, Postcards from the Border, started off with this idea. Joel and I basically flew to El Paso. This was in 2019. And we decided that we would take this journey by road following the border all the way from El Paso to Brownsville. And we would stop at certain locations, certain towns along the border, and cross over and talk to people on both sides. The gist of this idea, the seed of the idea, came from this ongoing debate that I have with my daughter, Elena, who has been telling me that I'm obsessed with the border, you know, that I talk about it too much, I think about it too much. Yeah, I said, yes, of course I am. That's where I'm from, and that's where your family's from. But more than anything, I felt like, you know, the news that we get from the border is almost always negative. There's always some degree of tragedy attached to it. And while there are tragic things that happen along the border, that is not the complete picture of the border either. My family has been living along the border since the mid-1800s. You know, many families that have been down there, generations, generations, generations. You know, it's a beautiful part of the state and of the country, for that matter. Life is rich and it's diverse. There's much more to living there than what we tend to see in the news. And so the idea was, how do we tell that other story? How do we tell the story that's not being told? I mean, because the fact of the matter is that the national media will go down and cover a story in Brownsville or Laredo or wherever it might be, when there is something sensational going on. And otherwise, I don't know if it's just the logistics of traveling to the border or what it might be, but those stories are not coming out of the border. You're not getting just normal slice of life stories that are reflective of that region. We wanted to find those stories. We believed that they were there, and we sought them out, and we found them. And they were at every turn. In fact, we had too many stories to tell. The article could have been twice as long. And so the program with Agarita is going to be just a handful of those postcards where I'll be partly reading and they'll be performing. And then Joel's images will also be shown at the performance.
Well, one of those postcards was from Del Rio, and Del Rio, for the most part, had sort of been left out of this whole border conversation when it comes to media descending on a tragedy until just recently. And one of those postcards was from across the border in Ciudad Acuña, and it was an immigrant story there that was actually very relatable to what was happening in Del Rio just recently.
Yes, yes. I mean, it was a bit haunting, just the similarity between the father and son that we profiled, their background, and how they had arrived in Del Rio. I can distinctly remember in Ciudad Acuña there being a great number of immigrants on the streets from different parts of not just Latin America, but the people that we had met were from the Congo. You know, when I'm seeing these stories about the Haitians and the route that they took, and many of these having come up from South America, which is what the father and son, they had been in Ecuador and had traveled the whole length up through Central America and through Mexico and had arrived at the border and then were stuck there. Yes, it definitely brought back memories of that family.
Oscar Casares, it's been really terrific having you on. We're definitely going to have you on in the future to share some more of your essays and engage in some more conversation. But thank you for taking the time to talk to us today on Fronteras.
Oh, thank you, Norma. This is such a wonderful program, and I'm thrilled to be able to talk to you for a little while.
Oscar Casares is the author of the story collection Brownsville and the novels Amigo Land and Where We Come From. He's contributed works to the New York Times, the Washington Post, Texas Monthly, and NPR. Casares collaborates with the Agorita Chamber Players for an in-person performance of Postcards from the Border Friday, October 15th at 7:30 p.m. Central at San Antonio's Carver Community Cultural Center. Casares' essay about the Dia de los Muertos altar will be featured in a forthcoming Texas Monthly collection called Being Texan. The book and Casares will be featured at this month's Texas Book Festival, happening virtually and in person in downtown Austin, October 23rd through the 31st. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show online at tpr.org and wherever you get your podcasts. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Lauren Terrazas. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our digital content producer is Bree Kirkham. Our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.